every 6 months, conceivably at least once a year, you could pack either parts of an antenna or a whole antenna, and your new antenna. So, you know, you like dishes, you like Yagis, I like dishes. I think we could start planting various things up there over a period of time, what works best, and have a real time at it. And, I mean, it's not, well, a lot of people, I guess, think, you know, you could sit here with a handy talkie and talk to the moon, or the other way around, you could sit on the moon with a handy talkie and talk to Earth. That would be difficult. But the moon is a big place, and it's a very stable platform. There's no wind. The only little problem you're going to have is, of course, the angle that the sun looks at your solar panels changes constantly. And that could be done. Very interesting idea. I think you could have your solar panels powered by the sun, turning servo motors to keep your solar panels on the sun, kind of like flowers following the sun. You know, as the sun comes up, and these things will just automatically find it and look for it. And that would work well.
I make it even simpler than that, Barry. What I'm about to say, don't do it on Earth because of wind loading and problems like that. You got no wind on the moon. Therefore, you could have a set of solar panels that are flat against the lunar surface, and they look straight up at zenith. And as long as the sun is more than 45 degrees above your eastern horizon and more than 45 degrees above your western horizon, you're getting more than enough sun on your solar panels. If you want to have a little bit more coverage when the sun is right down on the horizon, and you set up another passive reflector off to one side of the solar panel. I wouldn't do it due east or due west. I would do it a little bit to the northeast and to the southwest, so to speak, so that when the sun is on the horizon, the sun hits your auxiliary reflector, which reflects the sunlight back down onto your solar panel. And because it's not exactly due east and due west, it doesn't cast a shadow when the sun is on the horizon. And so you could now, with no mechanical motion of the solar panels, I'd like to keep it simple. I'm worried that, yes, the tracking motor is a great technique on Earth because you can easily repair the motor. On the moon, repair is very difficult. I'd like to have the system thoroughly passive, locked down to the moon, and just let the sun go sweeping by, and as long as the sun's above the horizon, you've got solar power. That's the way I'd like to run that. And the antenna... like what you're saying about the antenna. You start off with a 432 or a 1296 antenna. On the next lunar mission, they bring up a 2304 antenna and attach that. Later on, they bring up a 3.3 gig antenna and attach that, and so on. So it could be a system that continuously is being added onto. It would grow like Topsy. And now, because of all the antenna gain we can muster and all the transmitter power output that's not required, rather simple set of solar cells and batteries could keep this whole thing running, and slow scan television is definitely possible. Fast scan, I think, is a little bit difficult, but all the other modes, I think this thing would support. And two moon bounce, K2LIW.
You know, Dick, in the past, amateurs have done things which industry didn't think was practical, and then later on, industry adopted it, and found it was very practical. One of those things is media scatter, which is starting to be actually used now. I don't remember which company is using it, but they're storing forwarding messages, and when they get a burst, they can do, you know, the things that would seem so impractical, and amateurs have made it practical. I think all this stuff that we're planning on doing, and I know we're going to do this stuff, eventually you will find that commercial companies will say, you know, this could augment our satellite communications. This is not a bad thing, and we're going to start setting up equipment to do some heavy signal or data transfer here. This is not a bad idea, you know?
Yeah, once you've got a permanent base of people on the moon, maintaining your satellite system, a commercial satellite system, is now very doable. Each of our synchronous satellites that we put up right now, synchronous orbit satellite, 22,300 miles, are so far beyond the repair capability. if you burned every single ounce of fuel you can pack into the space shuttle, you can't get above 600 miles, 0.6 thousand miles, whereas synchronous orbit is 22,000 miles. As you can see, you send something into synchronous orbit, your eyes will never touch it again, your hands will never touch it again, it'll never get repaired again, and so it better be perfect. Well, and if you do a real good job, your $400 million satellite will last you for 8, 9, 10 years. And then it sort of wears out, uses up its consumables, you blast it into a higher orbit, which is where that's where the graveyard is, and you send up another satellite, another 400 megabucks, rough numbers. Putting something on the moon, it can be continuously updated. You can make it better and better, give it bigger antennas, lower noise figure receivers, more efficient transmitters, more efficient protocols for repeating the signal, digital communication techniques. By putting repeaters on the moon, we've now got one half hemisphere of the Earth talking at any one instant of time. Some kinds of messages don't have to be sent immediately. They can be delayed a little bit. A very dense package of some kind could be stored and forward. The moon, as it sweeps around the Earth, or as the Earth rotates every 24-hour day, every single human being on the Earth, with the exception of a couple of places near the North or South Pole, depending on the season, every other human being outside of the Arctic Circle will see the moon. I put the word see in parentheses, see it radio-wise. Your eye may not see it because it's a new moon or it's behind a cloud or behind the hill, so to speak, but except for the people beyond the Arctic Circle, every single human being on Earth sees the moon sometime during the day, and therefore the message could be transmitted. Even text messaging, as long as it's not of an immediate kind, every part of the day, could be sent to them in this manner. Yeah, the text message would be sent to a local gateway system that talks to the uplink to the lunar repeater, which talks down to another gateway, which talks to your buddy in Japan, we'll say. And so why would you send the message that way as opposed to the Internet? Right now, I'm not quite sure. In fact, let's ask ourselves that question, Barry. What does this system that we're describing have that the Internet does not already have? N2 Moonbounce, K2LIW.
Well, I think you answered it before you finished the sentence. The fact that it's very reliable and it's not vulnerable to crazy attacks, and it's a stable platform. So it enhances what we have. That's why I would want to see it. And I think once they find out that you could put so much up there that that would be repairable and I think it will turn out to be a very, very good adjunct to what we now have. Might have some military capabilities too.
I'm not so sure about that. The first time any satellites were put up, people made the naive assumption that all a bad guy would have to do is bring up a bunch of bombs, and whenever he wants to, just let go of one of them, drop it over whatever country you're passing over. Well, sounds easy. You just drop something from orbit, and it'll just go right along with you in orbit. You have to do a retro burn to get it out of orbit. So sending something from orbit down to Earth because you want to bomb somebody is nowhere near as easy as you think. And so when you've got your bombs up on the moon and you think you're just going to drop them, let go of them, and they're going to drop down to the Earth and hit whoever you want to, nowhere near that easy. So the military capability of the moon is nowhere near as great as you think.
Actually, Dick, I was thinking of the reverse. I was thinking of the vulnerability of the package itself to an attack from the Earth. I think it's far less vulnerable on the moon.
Now, when you say attack from the Earth, do you mean an electronic attack, or do you mean a missile attack, Barry?
A missile attack.
If you calculate how many dollars worth of hardware and mid-course corrections and everything else is required to take a payload from Earth, let's assume it's a bomb, and to accurately deposit it in just the right spot on the moon so that you wipe out that particular repeater site, you calculate how many dollars it takes to do that, and you're going to have an awful lot of trouble finding funding to do that project, Barry.
My point exactly. So that makes it less vulnerable, certainly less vulnerable than geosynchronous satellites.
Even a geosynchronous satellite, I once was required to do a calculation as to what it takes to knock one out. You would be amazed how difficult it is to do. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, so I'm wrong in that department. Anyway, I do want to see this project going, and I honestly believe that once it's done, there will be commercial ventures following. There has to be good use for this. I mean, it's just another place, and I think it'll work.
Now, the nice thing about the moon with 1/6 gravity, and if you operate your base of operations on the backside of the moon, it's always away from the Earth. You never get any electromagnetic interference from Earth, no radio noise. So when you're setting up your radio telescope and your optical telescope at 1/6 gravity and no air, whatever you thought previously was an overwhelmingly large telescope, OWL, just got multiplied by about 10, maybe 6 at least, maybe 10. So radio telescopes and optical telescopes on the backside of the moon have no restrictions.
And they don't have to be corrected like Earth.
When you say corrected, well, hold on now. Instead of once every 24 hours in your polar tracking system...
I'm talking about optical correction.
Okay. You're talking about now adaptive optics, yes. You have no atmosphere that's giving you any scintillation effects. And so, except for a little bit of cosmic ray problems, it's a beautiful place to operate astronomy equipment, whether it be radio astronomy, optical, infrared, ultraviolet, DC to cosmic ray, or the DC to light, DC to cosmic ray, radio astronomy, and optical astronomy. From the backside of the moon, that's the ideal place to do it. A little bit hard to get the hardware there, and maybe what you do is you ship the machinery that is capable of taking the raw materials that's on the moon and reconstructing them into most of the stuff that you need for your telescope. That's probably the right way to do it. You do have to establish a base below grade because during the lunar day, the sun gets darn hot, and during the lunar night, it gets darn cold. So X number of feet below grade, I'd like to believe there is a stable temperature like you've got on Earth, and that's doable. From what you're hearing, Barry, how soon will there, in your mind, be a permanent base on the moon?
Yeah, it looks like within 5 years, which is pretty exciting, actually. Does anybody on this repeater know what has become of the Sky Elevator or whatever that name of that project is? That's one that I think is absolutely incredible, and boy, that would solve a lot of problems. Like, for instance, going up and repairing geosynchronous satellites would now be a genuine possibility.
Yeah, what do we call that? I think it's called the Sky Elevator. Space Elevator. He's right. Mel, why don't you talk to us a little while? Would you volunteer for a project like this, Mel?
I want to keep my feet on the ground. Too old for it, Dick. Leave it up to young guys like you.
I'll go, Mel.
The three of us are close to the same age. Looks to me like two of us would go, Mel. You got it, Mel.
Okay, I'll wait for you guys. I'll drive you there. Say goodbye. Just not in the adventure spirit anymore. This is K2KY. Buried too many of my friends, and I figured that I'd like to stick around a little bit, Dick, because I went through already my 9 lives. I think I went through quite a number of them over.
Now, the friends that you buried there, Mel, you buried them because they hit old age or because you did something foolish that that created their demise? Which was it?
All of the above. Some of them, they died of, if you want to call it, natural causes, diseases, somewhat natural causes, brought on by who knows what. And in fact, one of my friends that, in fact, we also could have been our group, Dick, because he was a scientist, a professor in physics, had a PhD in physics and all. And a couple of months ago, he passed away, and they're not even sure what he died of, really. got something. And he died, and some people said the family said they believe it was exposure to what he had in the lab, and so on and so forth. A couple of others died of problems, things that they got exposed to back in the 60s, they believe, but things like Agent Orange, you name it. So, I'm sort of starting to feel I can get to be the last of the Mohicans to take over.
You're not alone, Mel. In my family, I am now the patriarch on the East Coast. In other words, I seem to be the oldest living member of my particular family. I think I've got a couple of relatives that might be a little bit older living in South Dakota, but they're kind of remote from me, don't know them very well, and so I'm it. And that at times is a slightly sobering thought. Each time I'm up my tower, adding an antenna or doing a repair, I can easily say to myself, is this a rational thing for a person of my age to be doing? And that's a hard one to answer. I could say the jury's out. I could also say that a more rational person would say no. I don't do it just because I don't climb the tower just like you don't climb your structures, simply because you want to prove you've got guts. You do it because you've got some actual purpose in mind. That radio tower of mine is a tool. Just like I make jokes, but I'm only half counting, okay, half kidding when I say, what is my house good for? It keeps the rain off my rig. The wife doesn't quite agree with that one. Well, in her case, it keeps the rain off her books. She collects books, I collect books, I collect electronics. So, my house is not the neatest thing in the world. My lawn is not anything to brag about. Those are tools to make the house moderately acceptable to the community. And the house, you have to keep the roof in good shape to keep the rain off your rig. So it's a matter of how you look at things. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm second in line to really say attention to the family. The older generation now is about all that's left. Quite a big family at one time. My father had 8 siblings. And they all had kids, children, a lot of cousins and all, and mostly all either scattered, few here and there left, but here I'm in the local area, I'm number 2, my one cousin, that she's about 2 years older than I am, and that's it. So, as I said, yeah, I feel the same way. I don't know, when I'm up the tower, when I did all that work last year, I said, really, do I need this? You know, but I have one or two friends that still live. Their thing is, one of them is a skier. He loves to ski, and he's quite proficient at it. And I always say to him, hey, you know, I'm going to break your neck one day. And Red, he says to me, his name's Red. His nickname, he had red hair when he was younger. His nickname, Red, and he says, you got to live. You can't stop living. That's true. I agree with that, but you know, some things are a little foolhardy to go out of your way. I am not going to take up tightrope walking, nor do I feel that at this point I'm going to do free basic climbing mountains or whatever. Climbing the tower is adventure enough for me, Dick. Over.
I have nightmares, even though I do some pretty tall antenna work, and I've got all kinds of safety equipment when I'm doing it. I have nightmares thinking about what Mr. Pettit, I think his name was, this Frenchman, who strung a tightrope in between the two buildings of the World Trade Center and spent about an hour and a half out there one day walking across that tightrope and eventually laying down on the wire, looking straight up in the air, and a hawk looked down at him. And he said that the hawk had an expression on his face like, what the hell are you doing in my environment? But picture yourself standing on a wire in between the two World Trade Centers, 1,300 feet up. You could rationalize and say whether you're 100 feet up or 1,300 feet up, you're going to die equally as fast if you fall. But still, there's something about that kind of altitude in that kind of an environment. I never heard him describe, when he was on PBS describing his adventure, whether or not he did a good careful calculation of how much the two buildings weigh. I mean, these buildings are each half a billion pounds, and if the wind blows against one of those buildings and wants to make its way irrespective of the other building, does that break the wider of his tightrope? And he's out there without a parachute, and there's no recovery capability in that environment. So did his tightrope literally hold the two buildings into a fixed position relative to each other? I don't think he worries about those details. So how in the world he survived that is just something else. So there's a guy who did something that's extremely high risk, where the true reward, other than the notoriety, is dubious. You and I climb an antenna. We do it because we've got a definite purpose in mind, to establish a particular antenna, fix the feed line, or put on a new antenna, fix the one that's there. The people who think you've got to live, and they drive a two-wheel vehicle, a motorcycle, that's a risk-to-benefit ratio, which I think is not desirable. Talk to anybody who's driven motorcycles for more than 10 years and ask them, did you ever have a close shave? You don't even have to hear the words of the answer. Just look at the expression on their face. And they're trying to, they're running through their mind trying to figure out which one of the episodes should I describe to him. Now, that's a very high-risk environment. And the risk there is tremendously higher than climbing a tower with good safety equipment. What do you think, Mel? K2RIW.
Good
night.
At 8 o'clock.
TAV. I think on a ratio basis, more people, on a ratio basis, more people get into trouble in their cars than they do on their towers.
Okay, TAV, give us your full call and your name and proceed with your comment, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Bernie, Kilo Echo 6, Charlie Alpha Victor. I just wanted to throw in a quick quote. I heard you talking about the gentleman tightrope walking between the towers. I read one time a quote from Carl Willenda, the patriarch of the tightrope walking family. He once said that being on the wire is living. Everything else is waiting. I just thought that was very interesting. I'm a flatland kind of guy. You guys are welcome to climb the towers, and if you need tools to be sent up to you, I'll be glad to run and get the tools and stuff. But I'm just not a big heist kind of guy. Anyway, I'll go straight back to the woodwork. This is Bernie, KU68.
Very fine, Bernie. Yeah, the people who climb mountains and tightrope walk, I guess they get a rush. They get an adrenaline rush from doing it. And to them, it's very pleasurable. Some people running a marathon get a somewhat similar effect. I'm trying to think now. Have I ever gotten a rush from climbing a tower? I've gotten quite a bit of pleasure when I brag about it. I've gotten quite a bit of pleasure going up there with binoculars and seeing how far I can see, counting the buildings in New York City or counting the whether or not I can see over the North Shore of Long Island to the Long Island Sound in Connecticut, or to the south over Great South Bay, Fire Island, Atlantic Ocean, or watch aircraft land at the Kennedy Airport. I get a pleasure out of that. When I listen to how strong the signals are, and by the way, lots of people used to write articles saying, don't bother putting your antenna any higher than your trees, because as you put the antenna higher, you just tend to put more feed line loss. Very respected people like Joe Wright at W1, what can I think of his call letters, right?
1JR.
W1JR. What was his call letters when he was in Six Land? If you, and there's a real trivia question for you.
I don't know.
867Z?
Yeah, I think that's, well, I'm not so sure. But W1 Joe Wright, the W1JR, put that in writing. He was serious. He had this monthly article in Ham Radio Magazine, and he specifically said, don't bother going above the trees, just get more feed line loss. And along come the guy from West Lebanon, Maine, K1WHS, Dave Olin, and K2RIW, who both had tower setups where, in the case of my tower, which has a big array of 432 Yagnis at the 105-foot level, and I had a separate rotator and a separate identical Yagi at the 70-foot level, and I could, with switching, I could switch to one single Yagi at the 105, compare it to one single Yagi at the 70, and my trees are 65 or 70 feet high. So the bottom Yagi just barely clears the trees. The top Yagi is 20-some-odd feet further up. And most days, most of the time, the upper Yagi on 432, listening to signals that are over the horizon. The upper Yagi had approximately 10 decibels more signal strength, day in and day out. Every bit of altitude counts. That's what I see. Dave, K1WHS, bought himself a house alongside of a 2,500-foot mountain that's in his backyard. He owns the mountain. And as he puts antennas at various altitudes on that mountain, and then he's got about 150 feet of tower on top of that mountain. And as he raises the antennas higher and higher on that tower, on top of the mountain, the signals keep getting stronger and stronger. So Joe was telling something that he, saying something that he sincerely believed, and it made good common sense. And hopefully he had other people who told him that. It wasn't just his own opinion. That's not what a man in Maine and a man on Long Island sees from strong personal experience. Of all of the years that I've listened to those two antennas, one high and one low, so to speak, one lower, there was a brief period of time, one night, with a sort of a thick fog, where the lower antenna was about 1 or 2 dB stronger than the upper antenna. The upper antenna usually was 10 dB stronger. There was a very foggy night once when the lower antenna was getting a slightly stronger signal. Very rare event. So if you're a VHF, UHF, SHF operator, and if you have the wherewithal, put it up high. This is now VHF, UHF. When it comes to HF, where the ionosphere is the major mode of getting the signal from point A to point B. Ground wave only gets you out there 30 or so miles. Mel, correct me on the exact mileage. But when you're really using the ionosphere and you're on HF frequencies, altitude now is not so clear. Mel is discovering that with his loop antenna down at the near ground level compared to a full wave loop at the 40-foot altitude, because the lower loop, he can tune it in azimuth and elevation. He can rotate it and tilt it. And therefore, he can favor the best direction and best polarization at this hour of this day on that HF band. And we all forget about Faraday rotation. In other words, you launch that signal vertically polarized in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, and you're talking to your buddy in Ohio, and if he had the right kind of equipment, he might find out that today, at this hour, he gets the signal strongest on his horizontal antenna, even though you launched a vertical signal. And for all we know, that signal, in the process of getting through the ionosphere, with the mixture of the Earth's magnetic field, giving it Faraday rotation, for all we know, that signal rotated 2.5 times, clockwise, on the way from here to there. And when he sends a signal back, it may only rotate 1.5 times. You don't get reciprocity with Faraday rotation. So where you're getting continuous rotation of the signals over a 24-hour period, in my opinion, and you can't thoroughly predict what polarization is going to be received just because you think you know what polarization you launched, under those conditions, to have an adaptable antenna in the shack with you, a loop antenna where you can tune the polarization, the azimuth, and the elevation, and peak the signal and nullify the noise, that's a huge advantage. So in that particular environment, the adaptability is more important than the altitude. If Mel had the wherewithal to do the experiment where he found out while listening to his buddy in, we'll say, Pennsylvania, and he tunes the loop for the best reception in the shack, and if he had a corresponding identical loop on the top of the 40-foot tower, which by remote control he could tilt it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization, would the 40-foot higher loop get a stronger signal? That ain't clear. But that would be a fun experiment, considering the fact that the loops are not that heavy, not that big in wind load, not that expensive, and you and I have the wherewithal to come up with an azimuth elevation rotator, and maybe even a polarization rotator. Wouldn't that be a fun experiment, Mel? And if you find out that, yes, the 40-foot high loop either behaves the same or better, either one is interesting, now you would be less reluctant to retransmit back on that higher loop. I know you have some reluctance to transmit with the loop in the shack with you for radio frequency biohazard standards reasons. But that loop on top of the 40-foot tower, you could now experiment with tilting it in all the possible ways during the transmit mode while listening over the telephone or being fed back on 2 meters, so to speak, your buddy in Pennsylvania, and find out what orientation gives him the best signal, and I know it's going to be different than the orientation that gives you the best reception. These are some speculations on my part. What's it going to take, Mel, for you to get a loop up high? Even one in the attic versus one in the basement. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
Oh, I think I haven't been thinking about it. This is K2KEY. I have the ideal rotor too. I have an azimuth elevation rotor, nice equipment. And I have thought many times back, I've got emails. This is what I was going to get down to, the emails. And let me tell you something. I've got a lot of emails that are basically from the discussion that we had last week about the loop antennas and also that PAC antenna that you mentioned. Go to that website to look at that PAK antenna and comments about that. So if you want to get into some of those questions. But I'm amazed. I've been flabbergasted with this loop now for the last, what, 6 months or so. How I take this thing that gets less than 0.1 wavelength on 75 meters, and it is a equal or exceed this loop antenna. I started to think maybe I'm making some kind of loop, something I'm not moving right with the outside full wave loop that's at 45 feet. And fed with open wire feed and everything. I did everything as plastic with it as possible, so that would be as scientifically correct. And my location is not bad because I haven't got any high objects around me, so I can't explain it on a valley or whatever. I'm 350 feet off the Atlantic Ocean, and all one, two family houses here, and in fact, 99% one family houses, and so my antenna definitely exceeds height on everything here. Yet, I have the loop antenna, the receiving loop in my shack, which is up on the second floor, which puts it about 20 feet, I believe, about, yeah, approximately 20 feet above the ground level. And you just listen and you say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? I mean, I got it down to more of the science. I got two of them in there, one inside the other. I use it as a noise phasing through the system of, I built a homebrew system where I have a noise canceling system and all, and a few multiplying type of devices. And a number of other gadgets that I've been tacking on to see if I can, take care of that the noise level, which gets ferocious many times, like 75 meters. But what is happening? Again, Dick brought up a very good question. What would happen if it went up another 20 feet or so? And, but of course, it's a bit of an adventure. Even though I have the facilities, I have a second tower here. And the tower is only about, 45 feet high. And I have a camera up there now. That's what I was going to suggest to you, Dick. If you'd like to look what's going on top of the tower, put a camera up there that, like I have, can rotate and elevate, and zoom, has the zoom lens on it, the whole business. It's fascinating sometimes just to look around the neighborhood that way. But the question is, really, yeah, what is going on? And that's where a lot of the emails I'm reading in take over.
Sounds like fun. Fire away with the emails, Mel.
Okay, again, now let's get back to this TAC antenna, T-A-K antenna. One of the questions was here, you told me that this guy is really for real at the reviews. He says he seems to be point that way, that putting a 40-meter compact antenna 10 feet above ground is going to perform as well as my dipole that's up 60 feet, my half-wave dipole up 60 feet. Is this possible? Are these claims just a bunch of hype? How do you answer that, Dick? Over.
I've got a couple of answers, and probably Barry, who brought this to our attention, has some other answers. When I hang my dipole at 40 feet, and I go from tree A to tree B, or tree A over to the utility pole, I'm kind of fixed in the orientation. and 4. The signal that I want to talk to that's broadside to the dipole, I'm probably going to get nearly full performance out of the dipole. And yes, there's a magic altitude where you get just the right angle of takeoff in elevation, because the Earth at most HF frequencies acts almost like a perfect mirror. So there's a real dipole above ground, there's a mirror image of one the same distance below ground, but the ground gives you a reflection that gives you 180 degrees of phase reversal to a horizontally polarized signal. Therefore, the dipole below ground is 180 degrees out of phase compared to the one above ground. That gives you a null on the horizon. At some other angle above the horizon, the extra path length from the mirror image dipole is exactly a half wavelength longer than the direct signal from the real dipole, and therefore the two signals add at that elevation, and that's why you peak at certain elevations. So depending on the altitude of your horizontal dipole, it's a relatively simple geometry problem to predict exactly what angles the signal is going to be, how strong, coming off your antenna ground system. So altitude has this variation in elevation. In a fixed antenna, you're kind of restricted as to what azimuth over which you transmit. Off end of the dipole, if it's not an inverted V or a sloper, you tend to have a pretty deep null. You build this tac antenna, because it is rotatable. There are a lot of directions where it's going to work better, particularly off the end of your elevated dipole, because it's rotatable. Good common sense would lead you to believe that when you compact an antenna, it's going to have less performance. Good common sense leads you to believe that. Absolutely, positively, not true for simple antennas. Simple antenna like a dipole. You read the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book, Antennas, which is one of the Bibles on the subject. You've got the three editions of that book now, but the so-called infinitesimal dipole chapter, I'm pretty sure, is in all three editions. And what he discovered, mathematically and in real life, is you can take, I'm going to give an example, an 80-meter dipole, 135 feet long, made out of 14-gauge household wire. Egg insulator in the center, egg insulators at the end, and you've got it suspended from the trees on your property, and maybe a balancing device and a piece of coax cable going to the center. Full, halfway dipole. You can start squeezing the dipole down physically by zigzagging the wire in all kinds of ways in three-dimensional space. You can put loading coils at the center. You can put top hat capacitors at the end. Step by step, you can make the dipole shorter and shorter and shorter physically and keep it electronically resonant at your favorite frequency. Maybe it's 3825 kilohertz. Yes, as the dipole gets shorter and shorter physically, it's going to become more and more narrow in the plot of standing wave ratio versus frequency. It's going to look more and more like a sharp V-shaped curve, the Biswas curve versus frequency. But as long as you've got a good antenna tuner or you're willing to readjust the loading coil or whatever, you can always make it resonate at your frequency. That's not a problem. But what he discovered, as the dipole goes to near zero length, yes, the amount of bounce back and forth of the signal on the dipole before it finally gets radiated increases. The number of bounces increase. You want to make sure the dipole is made out of good copper conductive material. You don't want any resistance there, because in all those bounces, you're going to be losing a little bit of signal on each bounce. Radiation doesn't happen anywhere near as easy as everyone thinks. We like to believe if the signal goes down, our transmission line hops onto the antenna. Once it's on the antenna, it says, aha, this is a great place to leave, and it just jumps into space. Nothing could be further from the truth. A full half-wave dipole, 135 feet long, that signal bounces back and forth roughly 30 times before it's finally radiated. And when you make the dipole very, very short, maybe the signal has to bounce 150 times instead of 30, but it still gets radiated as long as you've made it out of good materials. And when you make the dipole shorter and shorter, there's an extremely minor change to the pattern. It becomes, instead of a 68-degree antenna, it becomes a 75-degree beamwidth antenna, a little bit more broadband. The gain broadside changes by less than half a dB. the efficiency stays the same, the gain within a half a dB stays the same, the beamwidth becomes narrow, it keeps functioning, both in the transmit mode and in the receive mode. And here's where it really violates common sense. Every receiver antenna has a certain effective capture area. A full half-wave dipole in 80 meters is 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. You can use whatever laboratory equipment you want, traceable to the Bureau, you can confirm that. And you and I could have an argument, is it 8,421 square feet or 8,500 square feet? It's approximately 8,500 square feet of area. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you look at that dipole broadside, you would see a great big oval in space with that number of square feet of area. And for a horizontally polarized signal coming from the right direction, it sees that black hole in space, it gets sucked up by it, the signal appears on the wire, goes down the feed line, and moves the S meter on your receiver. And when you make the dipole infinitesimal, and it goes a half a dB lower in gain on both transmit and receive, instead of 8,500 square feet, I could calculate it, it's probably 8,241 square feet, something in that area. And yet, this great big oval of black space that you're looking at, if your eyes operated at that frequency, has this tiny little antenna, highly loaded with loading coils and zigzags and top hat capacitors in the middle of that oval. How in the world can that little antenna be sucking up signal from that great big chunk of space? That's a good logical question. And it's just a function of the fact that you've got an extremely high Q resonator. The signal bouncing back and forth 150 times in my example is high Q. Because of its high Q, it is on each pass of a signal bouncing back and forth, sucking up a little bit of that signal that's coming into that area. By some kind of magic, which we don't completely understand with radio, it has that area. So this tacky antenna thing, the fact that it's physically small, it should make you worry about its bandwidth a little bit, although the way he's made it with these helical coils, he's reestablished some of that bandwidth again. The fact that it's rotatable gives it one hell of an advantage. And so at the frequency it's tuned to, by way of you tuning the antenna or using a good solid antenna tuner, it's going to give you the performance of the full dipole. So I'll admit it sounds crazy. I think the guy is right. What do you think, Barry? And then if you give us a couple of your comments, you're the guy that brought this to our attention. Damn nice antenna. Pass it over to Mel. N2 Moonbound, KQLIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, well, I think he's so right that that I'm actually planning on buying one from him. I was going to call him on the phone, actually, this week, and ask him, you know, I just tell him I want to make one. But, you know, the guy gets so little to the antenna, I might as well buy the first one and make the second one, you know? And that's exactly what I'm going to do. I think it's $43, and if you went to get the PVC tubing and everything, you might save $20, but you'd spend that in gasoline running around. So I'm going to actually buy one from the guy. I'm going to put it on top of my tower, of course. I'm going to put it on the tippy top of my tower, so it's going to be as high as it can be. And then, after I've established that it works well, if I believe that it works very well, I'm going to try to devise some way to use it as a directional antenna. I'm going to have two of them and figure out some way to utilize this as a directional device. And over to you, Mel, N2MB.
Yeah, you could use a pair of them as a phased array. Mel, speak a little louder in the mic, a little bit closer. You're a dB or two lower in audio than you could be. You got it, Mel.
Okay, Roger. I thought I was speaking a little too loud. Barry, yeah, very good there, Barry. And, I got a number of emails, and I guess you answered it, that it is a good possibility that it's going to perform equally as well as your dipole. That's up to 60 feet. So the person asked me that question, there's your answer. Now, another one said that there was an antenna that was somewhat similar that was published in the RSGB. And a number of hams now, I understand you can get a subscription to the RSGB magazine, a monthly QS version of their QSP, I guess it is. here in this country. And he says there was an article where one of the guys took, actually, he took a quad. It was a 20-meter quad. And he just put the wire around the edge of the quad and just spiraled it in. In other words, similar to what this guy did, but on a little larger basis. And he said he was able to achieve terrific results even with an 80-meter version. Now, he only presents a 40-meter version at the lowest frequency he goes. But according to the RSGB, that they just said that you can take a quad, a standard-made quad, that has the arms made out of PVC pipe. You can use the standard spiral spiders, and they just put the wire around on this quad, and they said that, I guess it's another form of the loop. Here we go again. The question was from this person, is the person that did it with the quad actually says, what I'm doing is just linear loading a dipole. Now, is that the correct terminology? Would you say a linear loaded dipole? He questions me. He says, would that be another form of a linear loaded dipole, Dick? Over.
I think you can definitely call it that. Whether you call it linear loading, whether you call it a spiral type top hat, whether you call it a loading coil that's at the end instead of in the middle or at the beginning, doesn't make a huge amount of difference. There have been a number of guys who have written articles claiming that in the case of a vertical ground plane antenna, that if you put the loading coils higher and higher up on the antenna, you get a more uniform current along the antenna, and they wanted to believe that the more uniform current is going to give higher performance. I'm skeptical of that. It's going to give a little bit of difference in bandwidth of the Vizwar curve. I'll accept that. But is it going to make a huge difference in the gain of the antenna? I'm having trouble with that one. Because whether an antenna is, in the case of a dipole, full half wavelength long, or in the case of a vertical ground plane, a full quarter wavelength long, and you now, by whatever means, mechanically, making it very, very small, you don't lose gain. Except for that little bit of a half a dB of difference in pattern, there's essentially no difference in gain, which is a 12th of an S unit on a well-calibrated estimator. You'll never measure that in any reasonable situation. So making the antenna physically small doesn't lose gain. And if your antenna is starting off in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength long for ground plane or half wave long for a dipole, and you do something to make the current along the dipole more uniform than normal, I think the difference is very minor. I mean, you'd like the answer to be you're going to get 6 dB more gain out of it. And you can make that claim if you like. And if no one can confirm it, maybe you can put it in your advertisement and maybe you'll sell antennas, but I don't think it's real. Gain of an antenna, real gain, only comes from controlling the pattern. It's a necessary and not sufficient. In other words, if I do something to an antenna to take my dipole 78 degree of beamwidth and I squeeze it down to 3 degrees of beamwidth, that's what I did with my 3-foot parabolic dish on 10 gigs, I now go from 2.14 dB of dipole gain, 2.14 dB over isotropic, to that 3-foot dish on 10 gigs, because the wavelength was so small, and the dish is therefore 36 inches in diameter. As long as a 2-foot dish, 24 inches in diameter, 24 wavelengths in diameter, I squeeze it down to a 3-degree beamwidth in azimuth and elevation, where it used to have 78 degrees of beamwidth in azimuth and 360 degrees of elevation beamwidth. Because I squeezed down the beamwidth, that's where the 34 decibels of gain is coming from. You have to squeeze down the pattern to get the gain. You cannot get gain without squeezing down the pattern. I'm going to say that again. Without squeezing down the pattern to a more narrow main lobe beamwidth, you cannot get an increase in gain. The only way you can squeeze down the pattern is to find out that the antenna has enough wavelength in at least one dimension, horizontal, vertical, or both, in the case of a dish. If you don't have enough wavelength, you don't have the real estate to do the interferometry trick, which squeezes down the beamwidth. In the case of that 24-inch diameter dish on 10 gigs, which has a 3-degree beamwidth, plus or minus 1.5 degrees, I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. What happens when I go 1.5 degrees off of foresight? When I'm 1.5 degrees off of foresight, the left-hand side of the dish is a little bit closer to me, the right-hand side of the dish is a little bit further from me. Those two portions of the dish are nearly 180 degrees out of phase with each other. Therefore, in that direction, I'm starting to get partial cancellation. That's why the signal is rolling off. That's why that's a 3 dB down point in the main mode pattern. Interferometry. It takes wavelengths of width or wavelengths of height to get the interferometry to give you the beamwidth, more narrow beamwidth. That's what creates the gain. Without the real estate, without the 24 wavelength of dimension of that dish, you cannot make that beamwidth. It'd be real nice if I could squirt the signal out of the waveguide like a hose. I mean, the water squirting out of the hose has a very narrow beamwidth. Now, water is not the way an antenna works. If my hose has only got one wavelength of width to it, it's going to have 75 degrees of beamwidth instead of 3 degrees of beamwidth. It takes real estate to get that interferometry to give you that beamwidth. So once you realize that, you can read all the ads you want where guys are claiming tremendous numbers of dBs of gain. If they can't prove it by the pattern, a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, you will not get the gain without getting that pattern. There are sneaky ways you can get the pattern and not get the gain, but with realistic antennas, you must have that more narrow pattern. You got to have real estate to do it. And so this TAC antenna, this thing with the helical loading coil, because it's the full half-wave dipole only had a half wavelength, not the 24 wavelengths of my dish, only a half wavelength. And when you go from a half wavelength down to zero, essentially nothing is happening as far as its interferometry is concerned. You're not making any substantial change in beamwidth, therefore you can't make a substantial change in gain. I know this is not an easy one to swallow. The infinitesimal dipole drives a lot of people up the wall. You're going to have to read it a couple of times, you're going to have to hear it a couple of times before you believe it, and even then you're going to be skeptical if you're a normal human being. But when a guy like Krauss, who headed the electrical engineering department at Ohio University and had a lot to do with the Ohio science, the radio science laboratory at Ohio University. When you get somebody of that amount of wherewithal, world-renowned reputation, published a whole lot of good books, taught a whole lot of courses, you gotta kind of believe the guy. He's not talking to his hat. Says it in no uncertain terms. The infinitesimal dipole has almost the identical gain and almost the identical pattern as the full dipole. And now that you know where gain comes from, it isn't so mysterious, I hope. I know that's kind of long-winded, but maybe it's worth it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, but I got another question here that they asked. If they went ahead and they built this RFJD version, which is a little larger version because basically you guys starting out using a 20-meter cubicle quad in there, putting a 40-meter version together. This is doesn't require, I guess it's a fairly simple thing to put together once you have, if you have a quad or have the material for a quad. And that's the question. I guess it would be maybe superior, maybe, bandwidth, because it's a little bit physically bigger than the TAC 40-meter version of the antenna. And one of the questions says about have I ever tried building a 40-meter version of my loop? And the answer is no. And that brings up another question. If I built, now my 75-meter version is 12 feet in circumference. It actually looks like it's a square, perfect square of 3 feet on a side and standing up like you would look at a diamond, a baseball diamond with home plate at the bottom. That would be where my tuning capacitor is. And, it stands on a tripod, so I can turn it, tilt it, you know, and all make it and adjust the variable at the bottom. If I made a 40-meter version of it, would I be able to accomplish the same thing as the TAC antenna based on a principle of making a resonant loop? And now, that question, I don't know. I haven't tried it, and I can't give you an answer, give the person an answer. In other words, they're looking around it as the conditions right now on HF are so that nighttime especially, it's basically 80 to 40 meters for the most part. And 20 is spotty during the day, but that 80 and 40, especially 80 CW, has been very, very good the last few weeks. And there are a lot of people, I guess, have that problem of looking at a half-wave dipole on 80 meters and say, I haven't got the real estate. Now these guys are coming up with all these compact antennas. Do they really work? And now the question is, again, what would happen if I made a 40-meter loop? Would I be actually doing the same thing as this gentleman is doing, TAC is doing with his situation, or would I be better off with my type of configuration? I guess you could experiment and definitely take over.
I think the performance is going to be nearly identical if you do it right, Mel. In the case of a loop antenna that resonates at your favorite frequency, I don't care if it's 80, 40, 20, 160 meters, you resonate a loop and you make it out of materials such that the total resistance of the loop is small, so that the real loading of the loop is free space, Mother Nature's 377 ohms per square, as opposed to the resistance you've got distributed because you decided to make it on a 40-gauge wire. I don't recommend that. So once you've got the resistance out of the loop and you've got a real good tuning capacitor across it, which doesn't have a lot of resistance and scratchy contact on the roller bearing, whether you compare a loop to an infinitesimal dipole to a TAC antenna, in either case you have less than a half wavelength of physical length in any one dimension. Therefore, you don't have the real estate, the wherewithal, to more narrow the beamlet. Therefore, it's not going to have any more gain than a half-wave dipole within that half dB. A full half-wave dipole down to infinitesimal dipole, you lose roughly half a dB. I say a full half-wave dipole down to a reasonably small loop, which properly resonates. Again, you lose roughly half a dB. It's just another electronic method of making a less than half wavelength quasi-infinitesimal dipole. Yeah, the loop is responding more to the H field. The dipole is responding more to the E field. Those are minor details. Once that signal has been launched into air, and it's a reasonable number of wavelengths away from you, more than a couple of wavelengths, Mother Nature dictates that there is 377 ohms of impedance of space. That really means that whatever your magnitude of E field is, she has an exact magnitude of H field that will go along with it. You can't separate one from the other. Maxwell's equations and everything that Heinrich Hertz did, everything that Marconi did, are all telling you the same thing. If you know the magnitude of the E field and the signal really was propagated into free space, you know the magnitude of the H field. So whether you're picking up that H-field component with your loop or picking up the E-field component with your dipole or your infinitesimal dipole, it makes very little difference. If you have any doubt about the efficiency of your antenna, you can easily use conservation of energy to confirm it. Put 10 watts into the antenna, do it for 10 minutes. Turn up the transmitter, walk over there and touch everything. If everything is ice cold, and if that antenna gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio. There's only three things that antenna can do with the RF energy you send to it. It either reflects it back to the transmitter because it's got a VSWR, but you've measured the VSWR